All right, we're back on the record. Ms. Krause, where are we at? Are you going to continue with the previous witness? Are you calling your next witness?
If possible, Your Honor, we would like to have Mr. McGraw retake the stand and clarify a few issues for the record.
Yep, that's fine. Mr. McGraw, you're still under oath, and Ms. Krause, you can proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. The first issue that I think there may have been some confusion on, I want to briefly just talk about the tank at the Newtown injection station, the 1,200 barrel tank that Commissioner Chrisman asked you about. Could you just clarify how that tank is being utilized?
In its current capacity, that tank is only being utilized as pressure relief. The piping of the Newtown injection station is not such that the product can pass through that before it gets to the pumps or after it gets to the pumps.
Okay, and then there's another tank that is referenced with respect to this project, and that's the Targa 30,000 barrel tank. Does Highland or Kinder own the tank or any of the associated Targa Badlands facilities?
No, ma'am.
Okay. And then the other issue that the commissioners were discussing with you is essentially the difference between a gathering line and a transmission line. And I just want to clarify a few of the possible confusion points that we may have there. Now, is it your understanding that under North Dakota law that a gathering system essentially gathers oil from the lease site to a storage site where pressure is then increased?
Yes.
Okay. So here, the Newtown gathering line, is it being operated in such a way that it is gathering from a well site?
Yes.
Okay. And in this specific application, are the additional facilities required in order to operate the project as a transmission line?
Yes.
And I think I just want to finish with, so currently as constructed, the Newtown pipeline cannot be operated as a transmission line as it is currently constructed.
As it is currently constructed, no, it cannot be operated as a transmission line, to my understanding.
And I think that would be all that we have right now, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Hsu?
Yes, Your Honor.
Sure.
No further questions for me, Your Honor.
Mr. Fawn, go ahead. Hang on one second. Yep.
Okay.
Did any of that get picked up, or should we repeat that?
Pat,
can you repeat that?
Sure. You talked about how it's not possible to operate this pipeline currently as a transmission line. It can only be operated as a gathering line. And with these additional facilities, now it can be operated as a transmission line.
And could I just preface one thing before the witness answers, that he would be providing his answer not as a legal opinion, but as his experience as an operator from that standpoint. And if there is a legal conclusion that is desired, we could have a representative of the company who is an attorney explain Kinder Morgan's opinion as far as gathering versus transmission and the interplay with North Dakota law.
Understood. I'll allow him to answer the question with respect to his understanding.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
And my question is about the operation and how the difference in those operations, the gathering versus the transmission.
It is my understanding that the interconnection between the atmospheric storage tank at the Targa Badlands facility, the 30,000-gallon tank, that interconnection between that facility, taking crude at atmospheric pressure from a storage facility and injecting it into the Newtown gathering pipeline, is what converts that line to transmission service. That is my understanding.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Fawn?
No, thanks.
Okay. Commissioner Fedorchak?
Just to further clarify, and maybe the attorney needs to further clarify this, or you can, Andrew, but the key points from the company's standpoint on a gathering is the addition of storage and pressure.
That is correct.
For further transport.
As far as my understanding, yes, ma'am.
Not one or the other, but both. Not storage alone and not pressure alone, but storage and pressure.
To my understanding, it was taking the crude from the atmospheric storage. Yes.
Okay. So it's stored and then pressurized for further transport. So then in that opinion, just connecting to a transmission line does not convert a gathering line to transmission, just feeding a transmission line.
The feeding of a transmission line, it is my understanding, does not associate the feeding gathering pipeline into a transmission service.
That is not then considered a conversion. The whole line then, in the company's view, does not become a transmission
line. That's my understanding.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. Thank you.
Commissioner Christman?
All mine have been asked and answered.
Okay. Ms. Krause, anything further?
Nothing further for this witness, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can call your next witness if you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would call Kathleen Spillman.
Okay. Good morning, Ms. Spillman. Before you testify, I'm required to give you an oath, and in doing so, I must advise you of the penalty for perjury. It is a Class C felony punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both, and being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay. Go ahead, Ms. Krause.
Could you please state your name for the record?
Kathleen Marie Spillman.
And by whom are you employed?
K2 Engineers and Consultants of Mandan, North Dakota.
And what is your position with K2?
I am the managing director.
And could you briefly discuss your education and work history?
I have a bachelor's of science degree in chemical engineering from the University of North Dakota. I have a master's in management from the University of Mary in Bismarck. I have 34 years experience in the petroleum and refining transportation consulting fields, as well as operations of oil and petroleum facilities as well.
And have you previously testified before the commission with respect to these types of applications?
Yes, I have.
Okay. And were you involved in the preparation of the application for the project before the commission today?
Yes, I was.
And what was your role with respect to the project?
I was the overall manager of the environmental permitting, including field studies.
And I will now have you turn to Appendix 4B, which is the map book and also included as part of Exhibit 1. Do you recognize this appendix?
Yes, I do.
And what does Appendix 4B include?
It includes the maps that outline the route of the pipeline, the study area for the projects, and key observations made during the field studies.
Were these maps prepared by K2?
Yes, they were.
And do they accurately depict the field survey corridor for the proposed project?
Yes, it does.
Could you just briefly describe a general description of the project site environment?
The project area is primarily rural agricultural, including open grasslands and cultivated fields with existing creeks, drainages. Also includes developed roadways and a large number of oil production facilities.
Okay, and Kathy, could you discuss some of the cultural studies that were conducted in association with the project?
A Class 1 desktop survey culture resource Inventory was conducted prior to July of 2013 of the entire area. That was done prior to the actual construction of the gathering line. It was done again in June of 2014 as part of the final Class 3 study. The Class 3 study, which is the field survey where the archaeologists actually walk the route and look for additional artifacts and impact areas. It was conducted between May and September of 2013 and another portion in June and July of 2014 using a variable minimum 250-foot wide corridor, and as items were identified, it was extended as far wide as 1,414 feet to identify suitable routes around newly identified artifacts.
And a copy of the Class 3 Cultural Resource Inventory is included in the application, correct?
Yes, a redacted version per the instructions of the North Dakota SHPO office. They have asked us to submit redacted versions that do not identify specific locations of cultural artifacts, but of course the SHPO office was provided with the entire report identifying locations and type of artifacts that were uncovered.
And could you discuss the findings of the Class 3 report?
There were 28 previously unrecorded cultural resources and 23 previously recorded cultural resources, 34 of which were Native American stone sites, were recommended as potentially eligible for inclusion in the National Register of Historic Places. Beaver Creek Archaeology, who was our subcontract archaeology firm who conducted the actual studies, they had recommended those sites to be avoided by 50 feet, and any sites on Fort Berthold Reservation were recommended avoidance by 75 feet. While they were out there, they actually installed stakes and fences to identify the boundaries of such artifacts so that they would be avoided during those portions of the gathering system construction that occurred after the site studies were done. There was one site, 32MN562, which was previously identified by other pipeline studies, but had been destroyed subsequently by a pipeline project not associated with Kinder Morgan or Highland. There were four archaeological historic sites and four architectural sites. They were recommended as not eligible for the National Register of Historic Places, so no avoidance was necessary. There was one site, 32MN18, was recommended for avoidance by boring, and that was a railroad crossing. And if it wasn't required by the SHPO office, it would have been required by Canadian Pacific to do it boring. And that was done. There were eight cultural scatter site leads, and there were no evidence that the site leads were observed during construction during the pedestrian, the actual Class 3 pedestrian survey. And there was one isolated find that was not relocated during the inventory.
Okay, Kathy, I'll have you please turn to Exhibit 3 in the small exhibit binder. Do you recognize that document?
Yes, I do.
And what is it?
It is a letter from the North Dakota State Historical Society, or what we lovingly refer to as the SHPO office, that concurs with our archaeological subcontractor that this project has no significant impact from a cultural resource standpoint.
All right. So in sum, will any cultural resources be impacted by the project?
No, it won't.
And could you please discuss the approach taken to the environmental analysis of the project site?
We initially started with a record and database search looking for items that were already identified to avoid during routing studies. That included aerial photographs, topographic maps, informational databases maintained by the regulatory agencies, and they included the water well inventory maintained by the North Dakota State Water Commission. The United States Fish and Wildlife Service Wetlands Mapper, North Dakota Game and Fish Department, or the Fish Department's Wildlife Action Plan areas. In addition, there were site-specific information such as the presence of occupied buildings, protected species, or environmentally sensitive areas identified by one or more regulatory agencies. And we supplemented that by information that we had in our files to identify any possible conflicts. We supplemented all of the desktop studies with an actual field survey to a corridor total width of 500 feet.
All right. Kathy, you mentioned that some of the studies were conducted in two separate time frames. Can you explain just briefly the impact the timing had on the effectiveness of some of these field studies?
I'd be happy to. By doing the surveys after the fact, we actually had the opportunity to hand select the optimum time to conduct such field studies where we knew we had the highest level of activity of wildlife and the status of the growth of plants to make them readily identifiable. The post-construction also allowed us to assess those areas of the gathering system that had been installed to get a feel for how the restoration of the topsoil was progressing and to identify any issues that needed to be brought to Highland's attention. We also had the opportunity to observe wildlife that had returned to the area after the disturbance had occurred. The disadvantage, of course, of doing it after the fact is there are some things such as the tree count where we have to rely on estimates solely as to the number of trees and shrubs that were impacted by the construction. And as a rule, we're being very conservative with our estimates and probably tend to overestimate the number of potential trees that could have been there or shrubs. So the numbers actually might be a little bit higher than if we had done them pre-construction.
But a tree and shrub estimate was done, and that is included in the application, correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And let's talk a little bit about some of the findings of your studies. Are there any exclusion areas located within the project corridor? And if so, are they crossed by the route?
There were two exclusion areas that are located within the study area. There were several raptor nests that were identified with the 1 mile buffer zone that's been suggested by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. All the seven nests that were observed were deemed too small to be of either golden or bald eagle, so would not have expected any impact there at all. There was a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service sensitive species, Hookerstown scindia, which is a plant which was found in the corridor, but well outside any of the disturbance areas that were due to construction. So although several sensitive animal species were found within the construction right away, there were no species that were impacted adversely. There were no exclusion areas crossed by the route, nor do any exclusion areas constitute more than 50% of the corridor width.
Okay. Are there any avoidance areas located within the project corridor, and if so, are they crossed by the route?
Okay. I'd like to refer to Section C4, Table 3C3 of the route portion. And if I look at my little sticky tab, it's on page 40, is on the exclusion areas, and the avoidance areas are on page, about page 42. Sure. We're in tab 3, yep. And if you look on page 40, that has the exclusion areas, which I just spoke to. And the avoidance areas continue on the following subsequent pages, starts on page 42, which are avoidance areas. So there were two types of avoidance areas that were identified within the project study corridor. As I discussed earlier, there are several archaeological sites, and there are 19 residences that were located within 500 feet of the project.
All right. With respect to those residences, Kathy, can you turn to Exhibit 4 in the binder? And could you explain what that exhibit contains?
We highlighted portions of the route and identified the locations of the residences that were in subject to that 500-foot avoidance criteria.
And do the maps in Exhibit 4 accurately reflect the locations within 500 feet of the pipeline?
Yes, they do. I will point out that the handout exhibit today, I believe, outlines all of the residences. The map book that was provided previously as part of the initial application had omitted several of the residences within 500 feet, but the Exhibit 4 contains all of them.
All right. And then if you could turn to Exhibit 5 and explain what that exhibit contains.
Exhibit 5 is a summary of the status of the waivers for residences within 500 feet. And you will notice as of today, the waiver was obtained. So we have waivers. The project has waivers for all of the residences within 19 feet.
And I know there was a question.
500 feet, I'm sorry. 19 residents, 500 feet. I'll get
sure,
it.
Sure, thank you. I know that there was a question that the application states that waivers have been obtained, but it more accurately should have stated that they are in the process of being obtained.
That is correct.
Okay. And they have all been obtained now.
That is correct.
All right. Are there any other avoidance areas at issue for the project?
Not that I'm aware of.
All right. And will there be any significant adverse effects resulting from the location, construction, and operation of the project as they relate to selection criteria?
No, there will not be. I'll get it right. No, there will not be.
All right. And I want to talk briefly about some of the coordination that was done with agencies and governmental entities. Could you just briefly discuss these coordination efforts that took place?
If you want to turn to Exhibit 6, there are a couple of the key notification responses that we obtained by consulting with the various local and federal agencies. It includes a table. Exhibit 6 includes a table of the correspondence initiated and any of the responses that were received. It also includes a sample of the letter and email sent to various additional agencies. And there are some additional agency responses that were included in the main application, the consolidated application, identified as Appendix 4E, Exhibit 1.
So, Kathy, Appendix 4E in Exhibit 1 and then Exhibit 6, those comprise all of the agency correspondence that was initiated and a majority of the responses received, correct?
Right. There was one additional letter that the North Dakota Department of Health filed a little bit after the fact.
And if you reference Exhibit 7, is that the Department of Health letter you're referencing?
Yes, it is.
And could you just summarize the Department of Health's comments in this letter?
Per their standard practice, the Department of Health commented on minimizing dust emissions and impacts to water bodies, being sensitive to the noise levels associated with construction and other typical items that are a risk from an environmental damage standpoint during construction. The department did, however, conclude that the project is consistent with the state plans for control of air pollution.
And were any objections raised by state or federal agencies relating to the project?
To my knowledge, there were no problems or concerns that were raised by federal agencies or state agencies or the local entities that were not properly addressed.
Okay, and I know briefly, you discussed some of the studies that were done and the ability to observe restoration and reclamation for the project while you were out there. Could you just briefly provide some insight on any restoration or reclamation that you have knowledge of for the project?
Okay. Overall, as I alluded to earlier, we actually surveyed this entire route in two pieces. The northern portion was essentially in the ground and operating as a gathering system. So when we went out to inventory plants and animals, we had an opportunity to look at the vegetation that was reestablished in itself. And I've looked at the pictures, and there didn't seem to be anything out of the ordinary, given the fact that at that point in time, you're probably at a year and a half post-construction. And so the vegetation was reestablishing itself. The southern portion of the line, which we surveyed in advance of even putting the gathering system in, and it assisted the surveyor in identifying a route that would avoid the cultural areas that were identified. That portion now has been that year plus range as far as revegetation and restoration of the right-of-way occurring. So all of them are still in that important three-year post-construction period. I know from working with Highland officials that they're still in the process of following up with the landowners. They're still in that key three-year period for both parts of the gathering system and making sure that the right-of-way is properly restored.
Okay. And are there other permits besides the Certificate of Corridor Compatibility and Route Permit relevant to the project?
Yes, there are.
And could you just provide some of the additional permits that have been obtained with respect to the project?
Obviously, the railroad crossing would have had to have gotten an easement or a permit from Canadian Pacific. There would have been the active stormwater pollution prevention plan that Highland was using to construct their gathering system under the state of North Dakota Department of Health. And so that permit applied here as well. They asked for and received a permit from the State Highway Department for the highway crossing. The Montreal County also has a special use, what we'll call section line permits, to identify routes and get permission to cross section lines within the county itself. No air permit was required. They bored all the crossings and wetlands, so they didn't get a nationwide 12. So they didn't need one. I'm trying to think. There's got to be at least one more counties, states, whatever. If I think of something else, I'll mention it. But, I mean, they went through the standard to get the permits and obtain them.
Great. And one item that Andrew briefly touched on was some of the emergency response procedures that Kinder Morgan follows and some of the contractors that they utilize, specifically Clean Harbors and Absorbent Safety Solutions. Could you provide some information on those contractors?
I probably have the advantage of being a little bit more familiar with North Dakota than Andrew does, at least at this point in time. I know for a fact that Clean Harbors has the significant portion of their response equipment located north of the lake. Absorbent Safety Solutions are based out of Alexandria, so they are located south of the lake. And, you know, could anticipate a pinch point being that crossing point by Williston. So it's very important to have contractors available for response located both north and south of the lake, which they do.
Okay, and Kathy, based on your study and review and the exhibits and testimony you presented here today and all statutes, rules, and regulations that the Commission follows with respect to these applications, is the proposed facility of such length, design, location, or purpose that it will produce minimal adverse effects?
Yes, it is.
And will the location, construction, and operation of the proposed facilities produce minimal adverse effects on the environment and upon the welfare of the citizens of North Dakota?
Yes, it does.
And are the proposed facilities compatible with the environmental preservation and the efficient use of resources?
Yes, they are.
And lastly, will the proposed facility location minimize adverse human and environmental impact?
Yes, it will.
And I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Shue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Willen, could I have you turn to Exhibit 3, the SHPO concurrence letter? The SHPO concurrence letter says that there will be no significant impacts. In the bottom, though, it does state that they don't review the sites on the Manitoudatsa, Rikara Nation, that property area. Did you make any attempt to contact them at all?
Our subcontractor, Beaver Creek Archaeology, was in contact with the Tribal Historic Preservation Office.
Was there any response?
Yes. They were aware of the project and had no contrary, opinion offered.
Okay. Was that by email, letter, or just verbal?
probably verbal and email, but I'm not sure. But I have seen at least one email with correspondence between a staff member from Beaver Creek Archaeology and the Tribal Historic Preservation Office.
Would you be willing to supply it to us as a late file exhibit?
Sure.
In regards to there were highways and roadways crossed.
Yes.
Were they all horizontally drilled?
It's my understanding they were all horizontally drilled.
Okay, so there was no cutting of any roadways?
That is correct.
Okay. There were recommendations made by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and looking through some the application and that you provided, some of those have been taken into consideration. North Dakota Game and Fish also made some recommendations as well. What steps have you taken to accommodate the recommendations that they had? I think more specifically, they had safety measures towards Knife River, if you recall.
I don't recall those specifically. A couple things we'll point out. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I believe, pointed out that because there were no federal funds involved, that these are voluntary. But to my knowledge, everything outlined in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service letter was complied with, including conducting the surveys of things, as an example, the raptor study, looking for a helicopter survey out to half a mile, which is the radius, if you will, from the pipeline or the construction zone that's recommended for that particular species, and half a mile for bald eagles. As far as the river crossing, I'd have to go back and look, but usually the key consideration there is to keep the construction equipment away from the surface water so there's no opportunity for contamination, and it was horizontally bored. So right. That would minimize the riparian areas in the immediate vicinity adjacent to the shoreline.
Okay. I think more specifically, I recall that they had they were requesting something to the extent of shutoff valves on each side. I know you guys from your testimony earlier stated that you have a leak protection system, you have automatic shutoff valves throughout this. Are there any around that area in close proximity?
I don't know specifically in that particular area. However, if the high water mark of any water body is at or beyond 100 feet, shutoff valves were installed per code per the USDOT requirements. But I would have to speak to that specific area. You know, that's really outside from a construction standpoint. We're not that involved in actual design and placement of valves. But I do know that everything was in compliance with USDOT pipeline regulations.
Sure. Can I turn your attention to Exhibit 4, page 2?
Okay.
I was wondering if you can give us an explanation of what is to the right of that on that map. Are those temporary housing units?
It all depends your definition of temporary.
Right.
But I want to say that's a mobile home park, but I'd have to verify that for sure. But, you know, and it depends upon whether or not, you know, a house on wheels is temporary or permanent. I guess it depends on your definition, but I believe that's what that is.
Okay, was there any attempt to contact the people maybe running that mobile home park?
Well, you can see that residents 6 and 7 were in that park, and so I would say yes, there was.
Okay. Aside from 6 and 7, were there any of these mobile homes that were within the 500-foot?
I do not believe they're within 500 foot.
Okay. All right, that's all the questions I have for now. Thank you.
Mr. Fawn?
Lights on. I guess I can ask a few questions. One thing I was curious about was you mentioned another pipeline, not this pipeline, but another project had destroyed a cultural site.
Yes.
What does the SHPO do in that situation?
I don't know that they have a lot. I mean, you'd have to refer that question to them.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it happens. It was a previously identified site. It was, and I checked, it was none of our clients was put that pipeline in. So I can't really speak to it.
Okay.
But, you know, it's I mean, some of this, I mean, that's why you have trained archaeologists to go out there and assess these sites and identify these sites, because some of them are not readily apparent. A railroad crossing, obviously, anybody can identify, but there are some specifics that, you know, a pipeline, a construction crew would not identify as something that might be culturally significant. I will also point out, however, that it's just a potentially eligible site. I think, though, on that site, the conclusion was it was an eligible site, but even if they find something, that doesn't necessarily mean that it is eligible to be listed on the National Register of Historic Places. It just requires additional follow-up. And, you know, Highland's practice has been, you know, when something has been identified that might need to be protected, they just move the line rather than going out and evaluating the site. However, you know, in the last few years, with all the activity, there are some instances where they hire an archaeology firm to go out there and determine whether or not it's eligible or not. And if it's eligible, then they will avoid it. You know, if they've determined it's not eligible, then they will go ahead and proceed with their original intended route. So there's a different number of different ways it can be approached, depending upon time factors, willingness of the landowner to have the line moved to another location on their property, et cetera, et cetera.
The one you were talking about was, you said, was eligible.
I believe it was, yes. Okay.
On page 40 of the application, you have the exclusion area and avoidance area tables in this application. Your table says cross by the route. Is there any width to that you're talking about, or is that the center line of the pipe? Or
I mean, that's the center line of the pipe, but okay. If there was one of these, there's obviously a buffer that's associated with it.
Right.
So, I mean, it was not anything specific that needed to be done differently. I'll use an example, the ICBM site. I know for a fact, because we were involved with conversations with the Air Force, that as Highland was routing this particular line, they were in contact with the Air Force officials and intentionally moved the line to make sure it was outside of the exclusion area. So it did not impact that, and so it wasn't crossed by the route.
And for this table, the other column, it says within study area. And as I was reading through it, it seemed to me that the study area was 1 mile wide.
Yes, half mile okay. On either side, yes.
And then I just tried to identify what had been used for survey areas. And it looked like there were several different widths of survey areas. And
yeah,
the 250 foot was used for class 3 study.
Right. Okay, the desktop studies were probably, we initially used a 3 mile wide because, you know, we're looking to identify for them things that we know about that they need to avoid. So some desktop studies go as far as, you know, 3 miles wide or a mile and a half on either side, you know, of a proposed route. And at that point in time, the line gets moved more than once because they haven't negotiated with the landowners. As far as this particular application, when we narrow it down for this particular line, K2 did a 500-foot or 250-foot on either side of the route. The archaeologist did a total of 250, 125 on either side, with the exception when they found a new artifact, we asked them while they were out in the field to go ahead and clear, you know, a buffer area around it so we could turn around and give that to Highland and say, here's an area that you will avoid, and here's some area that's cleared. Now go adjust your route. So, I mean, it's a fluid, but at a minimum, the archaeologist cleared 250, and we cleared 500.
Okay. So for your table, when you say within study area as a column heading, you mean 3 mile wide?
Or no, at that point in time, that area is the 1 mile, is the half mile from my side.
Okay, 1 mile. So then, do we know if any of these exclusion or avoidance, well, exclusion areas in particular, are in the 250-foot wide study area or the 500-foot study area?
None of them were, you know, crossed by our in our route. No, there was no our. I guess the cross from that perspective, crossed by the route, there were no areas critical to life stages of threatened or endangered species that were subject to be disturbed by the construction.
Meaning the construction right away?
The construction right away, yes.
So crossed by route, we could really associate that with construction right away?
Yes.
Okay. How do you interpret, I guess this is a legal question maybe, but when the exclusion area, you have to implement this description, areas critical to life stages of threatened or endangered animal or plant species, and then there's another one that says areas where animal or plant species that are unique or rare to the state would be irreversibly damaged. You know, typically I think of an area as a geographic area, but I don't know that there are any designated areas for these?
Yeah, I think if you talk to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, I'm not the biologist on staff, but certain cliff faces along the river are deemed very important. I believe it's the piping plover. And so you don't want to be leveling those and trenching your pipeline through them. And the typical way to avoid impact would be to bore across the water body. Mm-hmm. So there are certain areas that are deemed critical habitat. Let me use another example, the infamous black-footed ferret. So if we were going to go into a prairie dog town in excess of 2 acres at that point in time, and if it was the only area, you know, in the state that the black-footed ferret had established itself, you're going to be hard-pressed to get them to sign off on allowing you to trench through it. So there are instances that are specific to each species, and the list for the state-specific and the region-specific from a federal standpoint are evaluated prior to doing any of the field studies so that the biologists are aware of these types of instances that they have to look for and call out if they're going to be an issue.
Okay, and so they have the list, and yep. They have a kind of a general idea where the areas might occur, and
yes.
So when they get on the field and do the field survey,
they're looking for that
more specific,
yes,
and can identify areas then
yes.
That way. Okay. I believe that's all I have. Thank you,
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Good morning, Kathy.
It good
is
morning.
Still morning.
Good.
So.
This is a good sign.
Yes. Just a few questions for you. First of all, help clear up for me, is all the land that this pipeline and the associated facilities are, is it all fee land or is there any tribal land that this pipeline crosses?
There is about 3.4 miles on the very southern portion that's on Fort Berthold Reservation. All of it is fee land.
Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Kalk will be proud of me because he always
asks that question.
And I want to make sure that it got asked almost.
Well, and I didn't take any grief from being a UND graduate this morning in his absence, and you can pass that along.
You don't take grief from me. You get accolades.
I know. Yeah, I do. Thank you very much.
Okay. Let's see. Tell me about the Little Knife River.
Other than the fact that it was bored, you're going to have to give me a little bit more guidance.
Well, how big of a river is that? Is that a substantial? Is it
relative
perennial?
To North Dakota? It's pretty substantial.
Okay.
I'd have to go look, find my water table crossing to get the specifics of it. But
why don't you pull that out and then you can direct it to me too? Because I want to just make sure we cover that.
Let's see who can find it first. Let me look at my table of contents. I'm thinking it's going to start somewhere on page 26. because that's the water section in the application. And here we go. It's table 3B7 on page 30 of tab 3.
Okay, so it gives the length of the bore. Does it, do we know how far below, how deep it is?
I don't know. How deep the bore is? I don't know that, no.
Okay. Do you know how those, how the bore depth is identified? How did the company identify the depth that it was going to?
You'd have to bring up one of the construction people associated with that. I don't know.
Is there
a
construction person here? I don't think so.
None of them.
Okay. As a late file exhibit, just verify for us how you established the bore depths. Again, that's a question we typically ask in a construction, pre-construction project. So just so we have it on the record, that would be good. Okay. And then back on the Game and Fish letter, their consultation. They talk again about the Little Knife River being a Class 1 fishery, so it'll be, you know, additionally important for us to get that, a little more information in the record on that crossing. But right above that, the Game and Fish says the pipeline runs adjacent to Lake Sakakawea. We recommend the pipeline maintain a 1/2-mile buffer to the lake. I've kind of looked at the route, and near as I can tell, it might be close to a 1/2 mile. Do you know if there is a 1/2-mile buffer from the pipeline to the lake?
I can't say with absolute certainty that there's at least a 1/2 mile. I'd have to look at the maps.
Okay. That wasn't one of the criteria you looked at in your
analyzing. I mean, if I look at the date of the letter, it was July of 2014, and I believe the entire system was in the ground at that point in time. So at that point in time, there wasn't anything that we could really do about it.
Right. Fair enough. And that's just a guideline. It's not a requirement.
But again, I mean, the typical practice has been, as the cost of horizontal bores have gone down, it is far more cost effective just to bore it and use a little heavier, thicker wall pipe, rather than try to restore the sense of areas in and around the shorelines and the adjacent riparian areas.
It's, right.
It has become very standard practice to bore the standing water crossings.
Mm-hmm. And is that why the setback? Just to avoid the sensitive areas next to the shore?
Sometimes they have to set back so they get the right angle. You know, there's a limitation on the equipment on what angle they can hit. So depending upon, you know, where they want to come up on the other side, you know, they might have to set it back so they've got a little bit more.
No, I get that, but not in terms of the boring, but is the Game and Fish 1/2 mile setback because they want... Is it a drainage issue, or is it because they want the pipeline out of the sensitive areas, wildlife areas next to the
lake? I can do is speculate. They want as far away as they can encourage people to go because of the impacts. The 1/2 mile is also important from a noise standpoint, and that might be the basis. There are other studies and other guidance that are issued for surveys by other federal agencies that assist in siting such facilities, mm-hmm. and they typically recommend a 1/2 mile from a noise disturbance. I'll use the raptor nest season, same mm-hmm. thing. It's not like the construction zone a 1/2 mile away has any threat to physically harm the nest. It's the noise associated with the construction. But that is speculation on my part.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right, and then you already talked about the reclamation progress. You didn't see any issues in your walkthroughs post-construction.
That's correct, and I also know in that 3-year period, the Highland does the follow-up with the landowners from time to time. I know they've sent out an update, the new contact information, to make sure they have a current contact as issues arise. There is somebody that they can call and... converse with and see whether or not it's an issue associated with the pipeline or it might be something else. And I know they do that follow-up with the landowners as well.
Good. All right. Thank you, Catherine.
Sure.
Commissioner Chrisman?
I don't have very many questions, but just on these avoidance areas, the residences, did your people work on getting the waivers signed, or is that something that someone else in the company
that
does?
Would either be the land agent by Highland or a contractor. We're not involved with getting the actual easements themselves or the waivers. That is handled by others, not us at all.
So would you have any idea why number 19 was signed over a year earlier than any of the rest?
It just seems like
such an anomaly to me, and it makes me wonder whether the waiver... Have you seen the waivers?
I have seen examples of them. I have not seen them in their entirety. But I will also point out that I think it was at the Market Center public hearing, there was a comment made that I think it was Commissioner Fedorchak that said that it would be wise for companies, if they anticipate there's ever a problem, to think in terms of siting and installing even a gathering system, keep in mind things such as, the criteria necessary for transmission. And when you're in there talking to a landowner, and you've got, you know, the land agent there, it would seem prudent to me to extend the discussion to a waiver if they're willing to sign that at that point in time. But again, that's something you needed to refer to one of their land agents. But that doesn't seem to me be surprising at all.
It doesn't seem to me that it would be surprising to get a lot of them done, but one out of 19 over a year in advance seems odd to me, so I'll just throw that out. And do we have copies of the waivers? It seems like we should have those, at least number 19, you know, as evidence that the person knew what they were waiving here, because that was way before this was planned as a transmission line.
So I'd like to have that as a late filed exhibit?
Yes.
Would the company be willing to provide that?
Just to clarify, do you want all of the waivers, Commissioner?
I think we should just do all 19.
Okay. That's not an issue, Your Honor. We can provide those as a late filed exhibit.
Okay, and I have no other questions.
Okay. Ms. Krause, any follow-up questions?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Hsu?
Thank you, Your Honor. I was just looking at the expansion project agency contacts, and it appears a lot of these were sent out to a lot of these agencies via email or letter on September 1st. I was wondering why it was sent out so late. They were sent out so late.
I believe that in projects past, contacting the statutory, I'm going to say 22 or 23, I'm assuming they've updated it to 23 agencies, it's my recollection in past projects, which have been more than one, that those contacts actually were handled by the PSC staff. And so the current practice is to ask the clients, the applicants, contractors, environmental firms to do that contacting. But I recall on more than one occasion for prior projects when a reroute was required, and I'll use this specific one at a landowner's request, and of course you're out there constructing and our client wanted it done expediently, and we had contacted the staff and asked for, is there anything we can help you do to move things along? They said, well, would you contact the 22 agencies for us? And we did. And so I actually have, you know, a couple examples where that occurred. Now, the practice has shifted, and I understand because you've got a lot of projects in front of the commission. You know, so we took that on at the staff's request. But I would tell you that wasn't always the practice. Don't have a problem with it, don't get me wrong. But it's my understanding we were approached and we did that those contacts here after the application was filed. But prior to that point in time, I think if you look at that date is associated only with those 22 state agencies, like my favorite, the State Aeronautics Board. We have always, as part of our applications, contacted the Fish and Wildlife Service, the State Game and Fish Department, the I'll call them the regulatory environmental agencies, the SHPO office. We have always done that typically prior to doing field studies. But some of these dates, like the North Dakota Department of Agriculture, I think if you cross-reference that versus the 23 agencies that the state or the Public Service Commission is required under statute to consult with, I think that's where that list comes from. So we were asked to do that. We did it.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Fawn?
Yes. I'm back to the tables on the exclusion areas and avoidance sure. areas. And typically the commission would when they write their order designated in a corridor, they would designate it at the survey for the survey area, the smallest survey area. In this case, the 250-foot wide class 3 survey area.
Yes.
But in this table here, we don't know, and we know because of your testimony that the 75-foot construction right away, there were no exclusion areas.
Yes.
But, and we know that within the 1 mile wide area, there were exclusion areas.
Yes.
But we don't know about the 250 feet. And so the question is, to me, I mean, would the company be agreeable or would they accept the commission's designation of a 75-foot wide corridor?
I think that what might not be clear here is the 250-foot wide that was cleared by the archaeologist was also cleared by the environmental scientists. I don't know that anything wider than that, but I also would be very comfortable with the 250 as being nothing at risk in that 250, 125 on either side.
Okay, so I think the answer is if you were asked if there were any exclusion areas in the 250-foot wide corridor, there you would say
there's no exclusion areas. The avoidance areas, I'd have to double check, but the 250 was kind of what we were expecting the corridor width to be set associated with this project. Certainly outside that 250, the archaeologists did not check, except, of course, where they were looking for a route around an artifact that they had identified. But, I can double check and make sure I'm comfortable with that, but I'd be comfortable with the 250, certainly more than just the 75. An example would be, the only exception I can think of where the 75-foot might apply would be the tree issue, because the trees, were limited to were impacted by the construction, which was only 75 feet wide. So at some point in time, if Highland wanted to lay another pipe here, then, you'd be looking at the tree issue again. But beyond that, I think they're completely clear based on Public Service Commission criteria.
Okay.
And the trees, I will point out, is not an exclusion or avoidance zone specified by the Public Service Commission. So I am, now that I think about it, very comfortable in saying we're good with the 250.
In other words, there are no exclusion or avoidance areas other than the residences in that 250-foot.
Right. And they're at 500 foot, so they're not even in the 250.
They're not in there. Okay.
Other than those that have signed waivers and identified.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
That it, Mr. Fawn?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Fedorchak?
I don't have any more questions.
Commissioner Crispin? Okay. Anything further for this witness?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Spillman. Do you have other witnesses?
Your Honor, could we just have a brief moment to discuss some late filed exhibits and just evaluate if we need to call any witnesses back?
10 minutes sufficient?
That would be fine,
okay,
Your Honor.
We'll break for 10 minutes.